Ruth, chapter 2, which you can find on page 222 there in the Bible before you. Our series in the evening right now is How to Treat a Human. We've taken that as our series because in our country we have, in very many ways, do not treat a human very well. Tonight we're going to talk about the economy, work and money, bosses and workers. So keep an eye on that. Bosses and workers, the working and the poor. Ruth chapter 2. Now Naomi had a relative of her husband, a worthy man of the clan of Elimelech, whose name was Boaz. And Ruth the Moabite said to Naomi, "Let me go to the field and glean among the ears of grain after him in whose sight I shall find favor." And she said to her, "Go, my daughter." So she set out and went and gleaned in the field after the reapers. And she happened to come to the part of the field belonging to Boaz, who was of the clan of Elimelech. And behold, Boaz came from Bethlehem. And he said to the reapers, "The Lord be with you." And they answered, "The Lord bless you." Then Boaz said to his young man who was in charge of the reapers, "Whose young woman is this?" And the servant who was in charge of the reapers answered, "She is the young Moabite woman who came back with Naomi from the country of Moab. She said, 'Please let me glean and gather among the sheaves after the reapers.' So she came. She has continued from early morning until now, except for a short rest." Then Boaz said to Ruth, "Now listen, my daughter. Do not go to glean in another field or leave this one, but keep close to my young women. Let your eyes be on the field that they are reaping, and go after them. Have I not charged the young men not to touch you? And when you are thirsty, go to the vessels and drink what the young men have drawn." And she fell on her face, bowing down to the ground, and said to him, "Why have I found favor in your eyes, that you should take notice of me, since I am a foreigner?" But Boaz answered her, "All that you have done for your mother-in-law since the death of your husband has been fully told to me, and how you left your father and mother and your native land and came to a people that you did not know before. The Lord repay you for what you have done, and the full reward be given you by the Lord, the God of Israel, under whose wings you have come to take refuge." And she said, "I have found favor in your eyes, my Lord, for you have comforted me and spoken kindly to your servant, though I am not one of your servants." And at mealtime, Boaz said to her, "Come here and eat some bread and dip your morsel in the wine." So she sat beside the reapers, and he passed to her roasted grain. And she ate until she was satisfied, and she had some left over. When she rose to glean, Boaz instructed his young men, saying, "Let her glean even among the sheaves, and do not reproach her. And also pull out some from the bundles for her, and leave it for her to glean, and do not rebuke her." So she gleaned in the field until evening. Then she beat out what she had gleaned. It was about an ephah of barley. And she took it up and went into the city. Her mother-in-law saw what she had gleaned. She also brought out and gave her what food she had left over after being satisfied. And her mother-in-law said to her, "Where did you glean today? And where have you worked? Blessed be the man who took notice of you." So she told her mother-in-law with whom she had worked, and said, "The man's name with whom I work today is Boaz." Naomi said to her daughter-in-law, "May he be blessed by the Lord, whose kindness has not forsaken the living or the dead." Naomi also said to her, "This man is a close relative of ours, one of our redeemers." Ruth the Moabite said, "Besides, he said to me, 'You shall keep close by my young men until they have finished all my harvest.'" Naomi said to Ruth, her daughter-in-law, "It is good, my daughter, that you got with his young women, lest in another field you be assaulted." So she kept close to the young women of Boaz, gleaning until the end of the barley and wheat harvests. And she lived with her mother-in-law. In a just society, you have an economy made for man, not men remade for the economy. Our Reformed Presbyterian testimony tells us this. The Scriptures teach that everything belongs to God, that the authority and power to obtain and use goods are given by God, and that men are to seek God's glory in the use of their goods. The scriptures direct how goods are to be obtained and used. No existing economic system incorporates all these teachings. The next subparagraph says, we reject Marxist communism with reasons attached. The next paragraph says, we reject that form of capitalism that denies the state the right to protect the weak and to restrain evil in economic affairs. The next paragraph says, we reject that form of socialism that denies the right to own property. We warn against concentrating economic power in the hands of the state. Let me read this. The scriptures require Christians to exercise stewardship over possessions, to give gladly to the Lord's work, and to give generously to the poor and needy. The tithe of the Old Testament should be the baseline for the New Testament. And finally, we read this. The church, regardless of the economic system under which it exists, has the duty to speak against social evils such as oppression of the poor. The church must never become the instrument of any powerful exploiting class. RP Testimony, Chapter 4, Paragraph 16. So we have the duty is to speak against social evils, and that's what we're doing a little of tonight. Jesus did that, and so did the prophets and the psalmists. Because in a just society, the economy is made for man, not man remade for the economy. I'm echoing Jesus, of course, who said the Sabbath was made for man and not man for the Sabbath. Now, if the Sabbath was made for man, one of the Ten Commandments, this thing by which we are to remember God, if the Sabbath was made for us and we are not to be remade in the image of the Sabbath, how much more should an economy be made to serve man and not man to serve the economy? Because we are the ones made in the image of God. The dollar is not in the image of God. The market is not in the image of God. The corporation is not in the image of God. Wall Street is not in the image of God. GDP is not in the image of God. It's people who are. Every person. Whether poor or rich. Whether master or slave. Therefore, a just economy is made for man. And not man for the economy. Now, at present, big business seeks to remake people in their own image for their own profit. I don't want to spend too much time on this. We spent some time on it a month or two ago. But the attitude of many businesses towards us is, as far as we are consumers, they'd like to make us addicted. The more you look into the opioid epidemic, the more hair-raising and evil it is. Particularly Purdue Pharma knew exactly how addictive their drugs were. And they knew exactly what they were doing as they gave people who had an accident or were in some pain from something far more than was needed. Easily enough that if you finished all medication, you would be good and hooked by the time you finished it. They did this knowingly, and then the other pharmaceutical companies said, well, if that's how you make money, we can do it as well. And even more, our pharmaceutical companies have not been putting that much money for the last generation into antibiotics or antivirals. They've done a little, but not much. And you know why? Because the trouble with antibiotic is that it works too well. You're sick, you have a bacteria, you take the antibiotic, you take 5 days, 7 days, 10 days, 14 days, and then you're better, and you don't have to take it anymore. They're much more interested in blockbuster drugs. And what a blockbuster drug means is that it makes billions of dollars. And it makes billions of dollars how? Well, they love the drugs that once you start taking them, the idea is that you'll take it for the rest of your life. Now, some of them are great. And some of them are wonderful. But those are the drugs they want to find. They want to find those drugs that you'll take the rest of your life because it controls your blood pressure or it drives down your cholesterol or it's an antidepressant or whatever it is. Those are the drugs that they want to find and create. That's where they put their money because they'll keep you on it for the rest of your life. Not those antibiotics that, you know, they just work too well. You can't make money on a drug that does its job and sets you free afterwards. And if you want to know why the transgender movement has come so far so fast, just think about how expensive that is. You have to fight your body for the rest of your life. You need to take a drugs to fight your body for the rest of your life. There's a lot of money to be made if you can just get a whole bunch of people trying to fight their bodies for the rest of their lives. They'll be dependent on your company and your drugs with testosterone shots and who knows what all else. Big business seeks to remake us in their image for their own profit. Gambling. Again, that's addictive. And of all the various addictions out there, the gambling addicts evidently are so miserable that they attempt suicide more than any other addict. Gambling. Tells you how far you go with gambling when you become addicted. I just mentioned before, I just want to remind you, we're currently in something called the attention economy, which is to say Facebook and the rest make billions of dollars by gluing your eyes to your little screens. Because the more time you spend on their devices, the more ads they can show you, and they can show the company that they're showing that you did see the ads, right? And so that is where all the ad dollars go, and they want to glue your eyes, and they know all the little mental tricks to hack your system. Keep you looking at the little glowing dots, and the little bells and whistles, and all the things that you, oh, I got another one, all right, as you look at it. I have a friend who's well-educated, got lots of advanced degrees, and it always bothers him that the schools in this country do not prepare people to start their own businesses. Well, of course they don't. If you start your own business, then you are competing with the big guys. They don't want you to compete with them. They want you to work for them and to consume their products. They don't want to produce competitors. That's what an entrepreneur is, a competitor. In fact, although you can learn an awful lot about sex in a lot of schools, money is a different matter. Because it's in the interest of those who want to relieve you of your money that you be naive in how to handle it. They want to keep us fools so that they can sooner separate us from our money. And how many companies right now are saying, hey, don't worry, women workers, we will pay for your abortion. Yeah, how empowering. How about you pay for some more family leave when we have the baby? That would empower things. Yeah, you want to kill the baby to keep me there longer. So fly me to California so that I can get the abortion. This is not empowering. You just want me back in the office because you spent some time training me, and now you're making a lot of money off of me. This big business, some time ago, a lot of them made a shift from trying to make the best cars they could make or the best computers they could make to where the real aim for most of them is to make the biggest possible profit that they can make. With the occasional exception, like Steve Jobs, because he started the company, he wanted to make the best products he could make. But pretty much everybody else needs to maximize their profits, because if they don't, they'll be out of the CEO's chair. And to maximize dollars means to squeeze the workers. Not much vacation. American productivity is up, but the wages have not gone up with it. Squeeze those workers. Don't give much family time. And it sure is tempting to treat customers, that is, people, like someone that you want to addict. Something you want to keep on your product forever. Now, as you turn to Ruth chapter 2, the first obvious thing is that we have a gigantic gap of 3,000 years and 7,000 miles and an entirely different economy. And I want to say that as I sat writing the sermon in the shade, by a table, on a fine Apple laptop, I was glad that I had my life and not Ruth's. Poor Boaz's. I think we can all be glad that we are not subsistence farmers working away under a hot sun all day. We have it better in many ways. So as I talk about economic lessons from Ruth 2, I am not suggesting that we'd be happier if we were subsistence farmers. The lessons I want to draw deal with the people-to-people dynamics. And since we're still people, we should be able to learn from the people-to-people dynamics here. All kinds of differences in a vast country here as opposed to small village life, and yet there's some basic people-to-people things that we can learn and that we should learn if we would have an economy made for man and not man made for the economy. Recently, I've been doing a little dipping into the book that started economics as its own discipline, Adam Smith. All right, his great book in 1776, The Wealth of Nations. I haven't read the whole thing, it's pretty thick, but I've dipped into it. And I've learned that Adam Smith was actually a moral philosopher. He wasn't an economist, he couldn't be, there was no economics, he created it. And he's a moral philosopher working on a moral problem. If people are selfish, how can you get them to all work together without having a state crush? And he says, a market, division of labor, pursue your own interests by filling other people's needs. All right, there you go. But because he's a moral philosopher, he thinks about people. The most important economist in my lifetime was a guy named Alan Greenspan. Alan Greenspan was famous for soaking in his bathtub
studying reams of data.
Notice the difference.
Adam Smith studied, I mean, everybody's doing lots of reading, but Adam Smith was thinking about people.
Alan Greenspan was looking at data as his toes got wrinkly.
Greenspan had a long career of being lauded and praised, and then everything went smash before he was dead. And so we've got all these quotes about, wow, I was so wrong. I have to rethink everything I believe.
Yeah, because he's looked at data, which makes the economy this sort of this standalone thing of machines and numbers and how it all works.
And you forget it, you're talking about people. How people will acquire goods and have what they need.
Let's look at roots and look at people. Before we get into it, we are told something very, very helpful. We're told that Boaz was worthy. Thank you. Often the Bible will tell you a story and not give you a signal as to whether this is a good thing or a bad thing. Sometimes you're left to wonder, am I supposed to follow this example or not? Well, here, they take away any kind of doubt. Boaz is worthy. No sarcasm. All right. What he does there, okay, this is how it should be. Thank you.
And you'll notice then the repeated emphasis that there was a relationship unspecified between Boaz and the dead man Elimelech, the husband of Naomi, father-in-law of Ruth. In other words, this is a story about extended family coming to the rescue. Coming to rescue a branch of a family that has fallen on tragic circumstances. You see, Ruth chapter 1 is closed in death. There's a famine in the land, and so this branch of the family leaves so that they can eat off in Moab. And while they're there, father of the family dies. And the two sons grow up, and they marry Moabite women, and then they die. And so you're left with Naomi, the old Israelite woman, and her two daughters-in-law, the two young Moabite women. And where is the muscle going to come from in a subsistence farming culture? Farming's backbreaking work. What is going to happen with these things? And so in chapter 1, Ruth and Naomi, they come back to Israel. For Naomi, she comes back. Ruth isn't coming back. Ruth is going to this foreign country with her mother-in-law. While the other sister-in-law says, I think I'll stay here in Moab. So Ruth chapter 1 is clothed in death, and they come back. And you'll notice that Naomi does not take anything for granted. She does not go and knock on Boaz's door. She is not assuming anything. It's evidently a distant enough relationship. It's not something that she knows she can count on. After all, it's not her relative. It's her dead husband's relative. That's who Boaz is. But God's law indicated that the extended family had duties. That's where the book goes. And so while Naomi doesn't know if she can go and make a claim, Boaz, he knows. And so Boaz, very deliberately, extends help and says, God bless you. I know what's happened to you. And Boaz knows that they're family. And the economy made for man does not promote the scattering of families. Does not transfer lightly. Does not say, Mike, we want to build your career by helping you learn this other branch of the business, so you're going to move to New Mexico for the next 3 years to master that branch. You know, companies do that. But the just economy doesn't treat Mike or any of us like a chess piece to be moved around the board. She's just like a person with a family and connections and kids in school and a house and things that you don't just put the person over there. After all, it's the extended family that comes to the help here. But it only helps when they get back to the village where the extended family is. You don't get much help from the extended family if you're not where they are. But there's something else here. That the poor could, and therefore were expected, to work for their food. Now that's a lot easier to figure out in a farming economy where work basically consists in walk out to the field and pick up your food and walk home with it. That does help work and food stay close together. It's a little more complicated for us. But you notice how they make it work. Ruth says, let me go glean. Now what is this gleaning thing? Gleaning was an anti-efficiency rule. Gleaning was after the harvesters, after the owners of the field do the first pass and they harvest everything, after that, they weren't allowed to go back a second time. You get one pass through your own field. And after the first pass through your own field, then the poor were allowed to go in and pick up what you missed. You weren't supposed to circle back. You weren't even supposed to make it all the way into the corners. All right? You get one pass through your own field, and then the poor get what's left. Now, that's your own private property. God said, yeah, and that's how we're going to take care of the poor, at least during harvest season. We expect them to go out and pick up after the harvesters. You'll notice that. She follows behind the reapers. Right, you're in front of the reapers, you're a thief. You are behind the reapers, you're a poor person who's gleaning. Right, maybe you're a sojourner passing through. And since they could go work in somebody else's field, they were expected to. Which meant the poor were not to lose their habits of work, not to become lazy, not to become entitled. They were to continue to earn respect. You can notice here how the young man, he respects Ruth. Like, she got here an early morning and she worked up until now, which is a short break. And then the Bible goes on. And she worked till evening, and then she had to beat it out, and then she had to carry it home. Right? There's respect for the hard work that she's putting in here. You might wonder, well, what about those not able-bodied to work? Like Naomi, who does not go out to the field. It's the older lady. Well, we have that too. Deuteronomy 26:13. You go back there, and there is a time when you go before the Lord and you say, I have removed the sacred portion out of my house. I have given it to the Levite, the sojourner, the fatherless, and the widow, according to all your commandments that you have commanded me. In other words, when you gave the tithe was not just to keep the priests going, it was also to keep those who were not able to work for themselves. So there was provision for those who were too feeble to work, but those who could physically work were expected to, because they could. That was understood. This is how it's supposed to work. Now, of course, you'll notice a little uncertainty there. Am I really, as a foreign woman, going to be allowed to do this? Let me glean where I find favor. But because Boaz is a worthy man, he keeps God's law, and he has respect and care for the poor. Particularly the poor, to whom there is some relation, even though Ruth individually is a foreigner. And you notice here that the boss knew and respected his workers. I remember being at the coffee shop, and there's a fairly successful man who pops in from time to time. And I was talking one time, he's in law, I believe he kind of runs a small firm, and he says, I'm a bad boss. He says, I should really be firing 10% of my workforce every year, but I just hate to do that. Now, that was a reference to the most famous American CEO of the 1980s, Jack Welch, who said that you ought to fire the bottom 10% of your workforce every year. He was the CEO of GE, which is to say he probably had 100,000 workers. And he knew that of the 100,000 workers, no doubt there were some lazy bums, so he said, fire 10% of them every year, the bottom 10%. All you managers can figure out who that's supposed to be. And because Jack Welch always hit his numbers for Wall Street, all the CEOs thought that they should follow the example of Jack Welch. And so even this guy who runs a law firm, I don't know how many people work for him, 5, 10, 20, right? He still has this idea, if I were a good boss, I'd be firing 10%. And they're thinking, it sounds like you're a good boss. Sounds like you're treating your people like people, not like human resources. You're treating them like people. You know they got bills to pay. As long as you're getting something out of them, you're not looking to cut them. Besides, you actually know them because your company's small enough that you know all these people. Not like Jack Welch, who never met the people that he fired. Notice, when there's a compassionate boss, he has a relationship with you, doesn't want to leave you in the lurch. Boaz, he comes out to the field. He's not an absentee. He checks in. And on the greetings, you'll notice mutual equality, the respect there. The Lord be with you. The Lord bless you. Sounds like believers greeting one another. Everybody knows it's bosses. Well, there's no need to be standing on ceremony all the time. Let's begin as brothers. The Lord be with you. Oh, the Lord is with you. You notice the respect he has for his young man. He asks him, what's going on over here? The young man has authority to let her into the field. Okay, it's not like, well, she wanted to come in, but I kept her out until you showed up. No, he's got authority. Right? He has that delegated right to say, yeah, sure, you can start in here. And so while there's obviously a hierarchy, even though Boaz owns that field, there's respect and regard and care. And the obvious reason would be the fear of God that they start off with. The Lord be with you. You know, if you're the owner, you're free to be generous. And if you're authorized by the owner, then you can be free to be generous. But in our country, very few leaders of companies are actually the owners. Very few are actually authorized to be generous. Get in trouble if you're generous. If we want to have an economy made for man, we're probably going to need more owners, which implies smaller businesses, more relationships. I notice that rule of thumb, like 5 or 10% every year. God owns everything. He calls us to be good stewards. That requires a profit. It does not require the largest possible profit. This requires that you didn't lose money. When you've cared for every responsibility, including treating your customers like people and your workers like people, and you notice this small farm is also generous to the poor, and then you've been a good steward. You notice here that Boaz does not seek out Ruth. Now maybe he should have, or maybe she just moved so fast when she got to the village that there was no time for any relationship, calling on family ties. Maybe she got out there the next day. Who knows? It was during barley harvest. But when the poor came to the door, he was ready. He was ready to go above and beyond and to be generous. That was good stewardship. So you have here an ancient example of an economy made for man, not man for the economy. And it's for us to think about how to do that in our own much wealthier society. So let's discuss right now this thing.